Good to see you. If you're new here, my name's Joel, and I'm one of the leaders in the church. We are teaching from the Bible every week. We have a chunk of the meeting where we read a bit of the Bible, and then we have some teaching to explain what it means and how it affects our everyday life. And today I'm looking further at the story of King David, one of the heroes of the Bible. This is the worst mistake he ever made in his life we're looking at today. His famous failure, a terrible, terrible sin, evil thing that he did. And I want to look at it so that we can learn, especially as men. Okay, this is a message that everybody in the room can learn from, but I think probably the men will land or will have it land on them the most, slightly the most, today. So don't be surprised, guys, if you feel I'm getting at you today. I promise I'm not getting at you. It will be God getting at you. All right, so just to put that in there. Okay, this is read from 2 Samuel and chapter 11. I'll read the whole chapter, so follow this with me. It's a fascinating story. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem. It happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house, and he saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. And David sent and inquired about the woman, and one said, "Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" So David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she had been purifying herself from her uncleanness. Then she returned to her house, and the woman conceived. And she sent and told David, "I'm pregnant." So David sent word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." So Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab was doing and how the people were doing and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." And Uriah went out of the king's house, and there followed him a present from the king. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. When they told David, Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, "Why have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house?" And Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah dwell in booths, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing." And then David said to Uriah, "Remain here today also, and tomorrow I will send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. David invited him, and he ate in his presence and drank so that he made him drunk. And in the evening, he went out to lie on his couch with the servants of his lord, but he did not go down to his house. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. In the letter, he wrote, "Set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting and then draw back from him that he may be struck down and die." And as Joab was besieging the city, he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew there were valiant men. The men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the servants of David among the people fell. Uriah the Hittite also died. Then Joab sent and told David all the news about the fighting, and he instructed the messenger, "When you have finished telling all the news about the fighting to the king, then if the king's anger rises and if he says to you, 'Why did you go so near the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, the son of Jerubbesheth? And did not a woman cast an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Thebes? Why did you go so near the wall?' Then you shall say, 'Your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also.'" So the messenger went and came and told David all that Joab had sent him to tell. The messenger said to David, "The men gained an advantage over us and came out against us in the field, but we drove them back to the entrance of the gate. Then the archers shot at your servants from the wall. Some of the king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. David said to the messenger, Thus shall you say to Joab, Do not let this matter displease you, for the sword devours now one and now another. Strengthen your attack against the city and overthrow it, and encourage him. When the wife of Uriah the Hittite heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she lamented over her husband. And when the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. There's a film I watched a few years ago. It's a little old now, called Match Point. And it's a film about a tennis instructor. He's quite wealthy. He marries into a wealthy family, does very well for himself. He's played by Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, quite a well-known actor. He's suddenly attracted to a young woman played by Scarlett Johansson, who distracts him from his wife, and he ends up having an affair with her. She conceives, and she starts to seek out this man, this husband of another woman, so that he will leave his wife and go with her. And now that she's pregnant, she feels she has more of a claim on him. Well, he rejects her, having only really wanted her for the kind of fling, but she begins to demand, and she begins to make threats that she'll reveal his unfaithfulness, which would certainly ruin him and bring him down. And so he, in the end, decides the only way he can deal with her, because she begins to get more and more emotional and more demanding and hard to control, is to kill her. So he takes a shotgun to her apartment and shoots her. She, along with the child in her womb, dies. And the rest of the film is the story of how he avoids arrest, how he manages to escape judgment. It's very close, and in the end hinges on a completely chance moment where one piece of evidence lands in a certain place because of literally, rather like a tennis ball landing on a net and bouncing either way, you don't know which way it's going to bounce, this piece of evidence lands for him, the right side of the railing that it gets thrown at. And it means the police find it and are able to incriminate someone else for the murder that he committed, so that he gets away with adultery, he gets away with unfaithfulness, he gets away with murder. And the end of the film is actually really a picture of him looking very contented, looking like his life is now taking shape, his conscience has been beaten into submission, and he's a happy man. He's materially set up. He's got a nice family, he's got a happy wife who's none the wiser, and he goes on perfectly relaxed. It's a terrifying ending, because what you realize the filmmaker is saying is that in a godless universe, that is certainly an option, at least an option. In a godless universe, there is ultimately no reason why there should even be a right and a wrong, let alone any reason why we should pursue right instead of wrong. We have to accept that. If the world is a place without God, if the universe exists without an eternal person who has set right and wrong before us and will judge ultimately our lives according to his standard, well, actually, right and wrong can't ultimately even exist. And the feelings that we have, that this is right and this is wrong, and the consciences that we have, are nothing more than mere biology, chemistry in our brains. It's not actually real. I'm not saying, by the way, that if you don't believe in God, you can't be a good person. The Bible, in fact, teaches very clearly that very often it's those who don't believe who actually live quite righteous lives. The conscience exists in us whether we believe in God or not. But what I am saying is that if there is no God, then ultimately there is also no right and wrong. Ultimately there isn't. this thing that we have, this conscience, is just an annoying leftover in our biology. It's just feelings. It's just preferences. It doesn't really equate to anything real. And I'm saying that because when I read this chapter, I'm struck by the fact that it doesn't mention God until the very last sentence, verse 27. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. You may have noticed, if you read the chapter again in your own time, you'll notice just how very matter of fact it is. It's like the writer is trying to make a point. The writer is trying to say, look how primal we human animals can be. There's no point at which the writer makes any comment, any opinion, any moral judgment. The closest we get to any kind of moral judgment or judgment of any kind in the whole chapter before that last sentence is when it says Bathsheba was very beautiful. And it's not a moral judgment, it's just an opinion. It's saying, well, she's a very beautiful person. That's the only place I could find in the whole chapter that seems to sort of make any state any opinion. It's all just said, this is what happened, then this, then this, then this, then this, then this. No point in it. Do you feel like the writer's saying, look how sinister David's become, look how wicked. No. It's just left there, matter of fact. And the world might just be like that if there wasn't the God who gets mentioned at the very end. If there is no ultimate judge, and really all our feelings are right and wrong, well, what are they really in the end? Especially if you can just get away with it, which it looks at the end of the chapter like David's done. He's covered his tracks. It took some effort. He had to ultimately go through quite a few hoops to get Bathsheba's husband to play ball. And in the end, it took killing him. But he did it. Covered his tracks, done what's necessary. No one's the wiser. He's fine. He's still on the throne. It's scary. Scary. A world with no God is a world of all kinds of possibilities. Why the Russian novelist Dostoevsky said, if there is no God, then anything is permissible. And he's right. Ultimately, he's right. Now, you and I know that every one of you, whether you believe in God or not, you will still object and say, yeah, but we believe there is such a thing as right and wrong. We can't not believe in it. We feel that it's there. Goodness and badness exist. It's real. It just is. We can't completely explain it, but it just is. But those things aren't real if there's no God who set them there. But here's the thing. If we say, well, in that case, we need to accept that there is some kind of divine judge. There is some moral law giver. We accept there is one. Thing is, friends, you've got to accept the real one or you're just making up God. Many people will say, well, God is just something people make up. You know, people who need a crutch to get by, they just make up a God. I agree with you. I totally agree with you. People do that all the time. We love making up gods. Question is not, do we make up gods? The question is there a real one? Just because people make up gods doesn't mean there ain't a real one. And this book reveals to us a real one who makes a lot of sense. And this real one, he cares very, very much about the way that we handle relationships, sexual relationships especially. He actually cares about it because it's right at the heart of how he's made us. Our sexuality and our physical bodies even are right at the heart of who we are. They're not on the edge. They're real. We can sometimes think of sex, and this is how we contemporary people, 21st century Brightonian people, tend to think of sex as like, well, it's something that's kind of, I have a body, and I do sexual things, but that's not me. That's just my body. And we like to think we can detach it, just like I detach this key from my key ring so that I can leave all my stuff in a room downstairs. It's convenient for me. I leave all my stuff. I don't want a jangling set of keys in my pocket when I'm preaching, so I just take one off. It's fine. I can detach that from the rest and carry on with my day. I put it back on later when it's convenient. We think, well, I can take my body and do things with it, but that's not me. It's just detached. Wrong. You can't do that. You can't take the body and detach it because your body is actually an integral part of who you are. Your sexual behavior, even your sexual desires, are an integral part of who you are, because it's the way that God's made you to be. The Bible says in the New Testament, in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 15, the Apostle Paul, speaking to a church, says, "Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? Never." He's saying the kind of unity that sexual relationships create between people is akin to the unity that God wants to have with you. It may sound like a strange thing to say, but he's making a very important point. He's saying that sex is sacred. Sex speaks of something much holier, much more profound, much more important than we realize, because it points to the relationship that God has with people. God speaks of himself in the Bible as a groom and humanity as a bride. The story the Bible tells is a story of a man pursuing a bride. The story of your life is a story of God pursuing you for himself, for a kind of married relationship. And so sex points to something so great that it means that sex itself is very important, and very important to God. So when we get into sexual relationships that are illicit, it's not surprising that what can follow is a whole list of other shameful behaviors, because we realize we've crossed a big line. Even if we don't understand it, we don't know why we have these feelings of shame and grief and a sense, you know, somehow this doesn't seem quite right. I tell you why, it's because it isn't. God wants sex to be done his way. He wants it to be done through covenant-keeping, faithful, promise-keeping relationships between a man and a woman, publicly vowing to be together and stay together. That's the perfect union of sexuality, because it speaks of his union with his bride forever. It's majestic, it's sacred, it's special. And when it gets transgressed, it feels wrong. If we're honest, it has always felt wrong when sex gets trashed. And increasingly, in a world that's rejecting God, it gets trashed more and more and more. Socially, it's more and more trashed. We bludgeon our consciences, just like David does in this story, so that you can get sophisticated websites today that appeal to married people and say, life's too short, have an affair. That's the slogan of a sophisticated website today. It's not unusual. There are various ways in which you can marketing carefully, skillfully, with savvy, knowing how to connect with married people to help them to be unfaithful sexually. So we're going in a certain direction, and socially, the truth is we're playing around with something that's right at the heart of who we are. And when we do that, sure, we shouldn't be surprised that the implications go on and on. For David, it wasn't just one fling. He thought it would be. He thought it would just be one few hours of rolling around with someone, or a few minutes. But actually, it resulted in deception, in the death of Uriah and several other soldiers who were faithful men to him, loyal soldiers, in the implication of Joab, his commander-in-chief, in a terrible scandal and hushing up of something that was wicked and violent and criminal. It never is just a small moment. It leads on. So one of my friends says, when a man walks into a sinful situation, he likes to think that it's just a bullet he's taking. I'm taking a bullet. All right, I'm going to go down. I'm going to blow it. I'm going to sin, but it's just me. It's just me. He says, you're always wrong. You're always pulling the pin out of a grenade. It's never just you. It's never just you. It's your marriage, it's your family, it's your kids, it's your future, it's many others who are watching, who are affected. It can have impact on generations affected by you. It's a bomb, it's not a bullet. And it was for David. The ramifications went on and on. In fact, the rest of 2 Samuel as a book is about the implications of these one few minutes he had with Bathsheba. The rest of his life is filled with sorrow. We need to learn from this man's mistake. You need to learn, if you're listening to me and you watching this, you must take this seriously. We must look at his experience. How can we learn? Because we're fools if we think, well, David's a bit of an idiot. I mean, what a fool. I would never do that. I'm in a much steadier relationship with my wife. I just don't do things. I could never. I mean, he's just corrupt. And friends, you have no idea. David was such a godly man, such a pure-hearted, humble. David out-holies any man in this room, any man in this city, and yet he fell. How foolish we are to proudly imagine that we are exempt from temptation, that we've got nothing to learn from this chapter. No danger will come near us. See, it's a deceptive thing. It deceives you. Temptation to sin is deceptive by nature. You can be doing something that seems even somehow right to you because you deceive yourself in the process and kill yourself. I heard a story of a hunter in the northern kind of Canadian area in the upper Arctic Circle who is catching wolves. And the way he does it is he sticks a bayonet in the ground and covers it with blood. And the wolf is attracted to the blood, goes smelling the blood, starts to lick the blade, licks it to get the blood off. Of course, because of the frost and the cold, his tongue is numbed against the pain, doesn't realize what it's doing, cuts itself repeatedly. And in the end, it's drinking its own blood. Has no idea, doesn't realize because it's numbed. And then dies, bleeds to death, drinking its own blood. That's exactly what temptation's like. It draws you in with something that seems delicious, seems attractive, appeals to you. Before you know it, you're drinking your own blood, you're dying, you're killing yourself off. It's much subtler than we realize. It's much cleverer than we realize. There's a few things that I would say are worth pointing to in David's story that might help us, because this is what you should be thinking, especially you gentlemen. You should be thinking, if David could do this, so could I. So why did he? And how can I learn not to do the same? That's what you should be thinking if you have any wisdom whatsoever. And I want to help you with that. So listen carefully. I would say the first possible reason Well, I suppose they all come under the one basic reason that he wasn't where he was supposed to be. You got it right there. In chapter 11, verse 1, it says, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem. David wasn't at war. Even the first phrase of the chapter, in the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle. In the spring of the year, when King, what was David doing? He wasn't at war. He wasn't at. He was isolated on his own in his palace, hanging around Jerusalem. He wasn't in the right place. Men, hear me, and women, but I want you to hear it, especially men. When you're not in the right place, you're going to get tempted. You don't tend to do the right thing when you're not in the right place. I don't just mean physically, I mean emotionally, I mean visually, I mean what you're looking at, what you're clicking on, what you're flicking over. When you're not in the right place, when your mind is not focused, drawn to those things that are before you. When kings go out to battle, well, that's weird. He's living in pre-modern times. He was a king. Wars, that's not quite my 9-to-5. I'm not getting called to the front tomorrow morning, as far as I know. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. You certainly are. You're called to fight. That's the Christian life, is a fight. That's the way it gets summarized by the Apostle Paul in the New Testament. Fight the good fight. Jesus speaks to his disciples like a military leader again and again and again. Watch and pray, says he in Mark 14, so that you don't fall into temptation. Watch and pray. Be focused, be alert, have your eyes peeled, be thoughtful, be on the advance, be aggressive. David's not doing that, he's a sitting duck. I would give a few sub-reasons under this, okay? First of all, he's living in despondency, perhaps. Perhaps, okay, let's just think about this. He's been involved in a military clash in the chapter before, at least his army has. He sent his army to go do it. Joab goes with his brother and they look to fight against this other enemy. By this stage, the war isn't over. That's why Uriah is still out at the front. The war isn't over. I wonder if at this point David is just a little frustrated, just a little disappointed, just a little discouraged by how far the war hasn't gone. I just wonder if that's the case. I wonder if he's just disappointed with the fact that it hasn't been sorted out yet. Listen, disappointment, brothers, listen to me. Disappointment in your life is definitely a potential seedbed for dangerous temptations. When you feel like you yearned for something that hasn't come your way, you've looked forward to things and it didn't click, it didn't take place. The Bible says in Proverbs chapter 13, hope deferred makes the heart sick. And you can not realize that your heart is a bit sick. You cannot quite notice it. You pray for something to happen and it doesn't happen. You pray and pray. You pray and pray and pray. You really pray like you never prayed before. And God doesn't answer your prayer. Or several things that you had pinned your hopes to all go wrong, perhaps within short time of each other. Disappointment creeps in. I had a friend in the last few years who lives in a different city, pastor of a church. In many ways, my life was parallel with his. I thought, your story is scarily similar to mine. Committed adultery, unfaithful to his wife. And it was terrible. For a long time, his marriage was looking shaky. By God's amazing mercy, it's being restored, which is fantastic news. But I asked him, I said, what happened? Why did you do this? I wanted to know. Don't you want to know? What happened to you? He said, discouragement is dangerous. That was his phrase. Discouragement. You can yield to a place of discouragement as though it's the norm, as though it's the default mode in your heart. This is what it's like for me. I'm just disappointed, discouraged. Life's passed me by. Things I wanted haven't come. And you can stay there and not realize that you're becoming more and more susceptible. I wonder if there was some of that in David's heart. I just wonder. I think as well as that, I would say you could see also in his life a pattern of war weariness. If you ever come across the phrase war battle hardened, you know, guys who can fight in battles so many times that they're just gnarled soldiers, professional soldiers. They're up for any fight. They can just take it because, well, I've been there. I've seen the worst. I can take anything. You know, that isn't actually all that common. If you read the historians, if you read the military historians, I was reading a book by a man called Max Hastings a few years ago who made this point. The more typical case is the guy who never wants to see it again. That's the more typical. When the guy has seen real bloodshed, when the guy's just come back from, I don't know, Afghanistan or Iraq, or just come back from Libya, or just come back from the Second World War, the general tone is, I could never go back. I couldn't. I don't ever make me go back and see it. David had been through a lot of war, a lot of suffering, been on the end of a lot of attacks. I just wonder if what's crept into him is a slight sense of war weariness. He doesn't want to be at the front. He doesn't want to be in the battle anymore because it's just been too, he's not healed up. I just wonder. I don't know that. I just wonder if that's crept in. I tell you this, what I do know is that can creep in. That can creep into the Christian man or woman. A sense of just, I'm just weary of the battle. I'm just weary of the fight. I just don't want to be in it anymore. I don't want to even bother. Do you know what it can become? It can actually become a sense of entitlement. Even a sense of self-pity. I don't have to fight anymore because I've already suffered. I don't have to fight this temptation. In fact, I deserve this habit. I deserve this sin. I should have this woman. Because life's been hard to me. It's been a pain. So why shouldn't I have just a little bit of gratification? Why should I not just click on this website? Why should I not just phone her up? Why should I not just send this text message? Why should I not just linger in the office a few hours after, or a few minutes after? Why should I not just hang back in the car park for a little bit longer? Why shouldn't I? Why shouldn't I? Life's been hard to me. And no one understands what I go through. I tell you what, this is why a lot of politicians fall into sin. Because they are so tired of being moaned at. They're so tired of criticism in the press. They're so tired. No one understands my job, they think. No one understands the burden, the pressure. No one gets it. They just write their columns. They don't understand that I can't do the thing they suggest, because if I do that, they'll just moan about this instead. It's just so difficult to be a leader. So I deserve a little bit of sin, a little bit of gratification. Come on. Sense of entitlement. I deserve this. I'm sure there's some of that going on in this man's heart. Come on, no one gets what it's like to be king. I'm just weary. Guys, watch that. Watch your sense of entitlement. Watch your sense of self-pity. Maybe it's the opposite of this, or a little bit. You could have a bizarre... Sin is a weird concoction, a weird old cauldron of mixed motives. Because as well as a sense of self-pity, you can have a weird sense of self-satisfaction. I've achieved. I've done it. I've got there. I can sit in the palace while the guys are slogging out in the trenches because I made it. I'm the king now. I've got my name on the door. I've got the crown. I am settled. I am established. Stephen Sample wrote a book called The Contrarian's Guide to Leadership, and there's a chapter in that that's worth the price of the book. It's called Doing President versus Being President. Here's the thing, guys. You can be thoroughly ambitious. You want to do things. You want to achieve things. But if you stop and consider for a moment, what is it that you really want to do and achieve? You might realize the thing you really want to do, the thing you really want to achieve is status. That's really all you want. And when you've got, this is the problem. If that's your attitude, when you've got the status, you don't know what to do. There's nothing left to do. But what's the point? I've done it. I've achieved. So a lot of presidents and prime ministers, they get into the White House, they get into number 10, they don't know what to do next. They've made all these promises to get there. You know, if you elect me and I will do X, Y, and Z. They get their first foot into the door and they don't want to do any of it because they only said those things to get in, and now the battle is to stay in. And if it means saying no to all the things I promised, then fair enough, because the only thing I care about is status, staying in. That is a temptation, again, for all people, in whatever situation. The main thing here is status. Maybe for David, he's drifted into that. I just want to keep my reputation, I want to keep my honor, keep my status. Friends, if that's your attitude, you are a sitting duck for temptation. You're not at war anymore. You're not in the fight. You're not in the game. You don't care less. You could do that as a Christian. You can go to church, brothers, and you're not at war. You're not in the fight. You're not trying to win anything. There's no battle left. There's no adrenaline left. There's no aggression. Your blood is cold. And you could do the religious thing as well as the next guy. That's fine, but you can't remember the last time you got excited about doing anything for Jesus. And it even dries up into a kind of harsh cynicism where a leader comes along and says, we're going to do this as a church now. We're going to go that way. And you're so locked up in complacency that you see that as, well, just another idea, just another idea. And God's reaching out to you to stir your blood again. Say, come on, come to the battle. Come and fight. Come and die. Come and be part of God's greatest project on planet Earth, the Church of Jesus Christ. But you're not in the game. You're not in the battle. You don't care. You're just spiritually dull like David was in this story. That can happen to David, one of the greatest warriors in world history. Friend, it can happen to you. It probably has. It's definitely happened to me. God help us. God help us to stay zealous. Do you hear what I'm saying? Brothers, do you hear what I'm saying? I'm talking to you. I'm talking to all of you. Ask Jesus to help you to stay zealous, to stay earnest, to stay hungry. Be killing sin or it will be killing you. As John Owen used to say. I prayed that prayer for years of Jabez. Someone even wrote a book, The Prayer of Jabez. You ever heard that from 1 Chronicles? Oh, that you would bless me and enlarge my borders. Oh, that you would bless me and enlarge my borders. It's a good prayer. I felt like God said to me once, why should I enlarge your borders if you won't let me enlarge you? Why should God give you your ambitions if you won't let him enlarge you? I'll tell you what, an enlarged man with enlarged borders is a leader. A small man with enlarged borders is a politician. If you want to be a person with big territory, big borders, big influence, big trajectory, big career, then become a big man inside. Be a fighter, be a warrior, push through. Turn the I wants into I want God. I want this, I want her, I want this relationship. Turn it into I want God. That's the solution. I want him. I want him more than I want this, more than I want that gratification. It's what you want, friends. Well, I deserve this. No, you don't. You deserve death. You don't deserve sin. You don't deserve instant sexual gratification. You deserve death. It's by God's mercy that you're still alive. Or I can handle this. No, 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 no. You can't handle this. You can't. You can't handle the next minute. You need God. You need to come begging his mercy. You need to come saying, God, I trust you. I give this to you. I ask for your help. I humble myself and I say, you're in charge. I need your help to overcome this temptation, this battle, this struggle, this relationship. I've got to have you. Do you know what that will probably mean? It will mean God will say, okay, if you want my help, I'm going to help you through some friends of mine. And that's the bit that often guys balk at. I can't tell you the number of guys that have come to me, sometimes with great emotion, with tears, saying, please pray for me, help me. I'm going through a terrible battle of temptation. I need help. I need to change. I need God in my life. And I say to them, okay, I'll pray for you. But I want you to know that the best advice I give to you now is that you join a small group and you sit down with some men regularly to talk this issue through. You can't see them for dust. It's rubbish. It's rubbish. I want God's help. I just don't want God. I want God's help. I just want it on my terms. I want God's help. I just don't want him to show up with his Christian friends and ask me Christian questions and get in my face and talk about my Christian life. I hate that. But I really need help because I'm desperate. Just not that desperate. Guys, if you really need God, you've got to be allowed. You just got to allow him. You've got to trust him. Say, God, okay. Okay, I give up my rights. I yield. I let Jesus into my life. I let his church into my life. I let his friends into my life. I let God in. And here's the thing, the person you're letting in, and I'll close with this, is like no one else. We're talking about a king here who saw a woman he wanted on a shallow, superficial, erotic level. He took her, he used her, he shamed and defiled her. And he protected himself. David, in most of the stories I've told you about him, reminds me of Jesus in a very positive way. Do you know what? Here he reminds me of Jesus in a very negative way because he is the opposite. Jesus saw a bride he wanted. Not from just shallow, selfish, greedy motives, but from genuine, deep love. And where she was covered in shame, just like you and I feel after a sermon like this, he took her shame. He took it upon himself. He received it upon himself when he died on the tree, when Jesus was crucified. He was doing the opposite of David. He was taking the shame away so that he could say to this much guilty and wronged bride, the church, when he sees you in your shame and sin, stinking, thinking, I can't even look you in the eyes. I'm so defiled. I'm so covered in guilt and shame. How can a holy God want to be my friend? Who could pay the price? Who could deal with the stain? Who could deal with the ugliness and the filth and the rottenness I feel? Who could? I can't possibly be friends with God. Who could possibly love me now? No one could, no one will, no one will deal with the horror and the burden that I am. And this is what he's done. This is what he's done freely for you. He came and he took your shame. And where David did anything, including murder, to preserve himself, Jesus took no lives. He gave his own. Jesus was murdered to preserve your righteousness, to give you back your innocence, to take away your shame and your grief. There's no one here and no one watching this who needs fear that by coming to Jesus, you're coming to a finger-pointing, accusing judge. You're coming to a Savior who can give you back your hope, your cleanness. You're giving back your future. Yeah, you may have to confess things. You may have to go to your wife and say, I've done this. You may have to deal with all kinds of horror from the past. You may have to. You may have to walk through some pain, but you can walk through it knowing that the only person whose opinion counts the most beloved, wonderful person in the world is on my side. He's cleansed me. He's forgiven me. And because I'm forgiven, I can walk through any hailstorm of shame. I can, because I have honor from him. I'm honored. I'm clothed with honor.